Welcome to today's reading of the Midland Reporter Telegram and the Odessa American, read by volunteers and staff. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
Hello, this is Michael reading the Midland Reporter Telegram for Tuesday, July 7th, 2020. Front page. Coronavirus. City reports 155 new cases, 16th and 17th deaths, by Stuart Doreen. The Midland Health Department had its first report of 100 or more confirmed coronavirus cases Monday, and the total ended being a lot more. The report showed 155 cases, which is the most cases reported in one day, and by itself makes this week the third most cases of any week since the start of the pandemic. It was a report from 4 days, including last Friday, but the addition of 114 cases on Friday through Sunday and another 41 Monday pushed the total during the pandemic into new territory, as there are now 927 confirmed cases inside Midland County. The Midland Health Department also reported the 16th and 17th COVID-19-related deaths. The 16th man was a man in his 50s. He died Saturday, according to the city. He was being treated at a hospital in San Antonio. The 17th death was a man in his 70s. He died Sunday, according to the city. He was being treated at Midland Memorial. They were the fourth and fifth COVID-related deaths involving Midland County residents since June 1st. There have been 798 confirmed cases since June 1st. Of the active cases in Midland County, 661 are self-isolating at home. The number of Midland County residents who tested positive and then recovered went from 169 on Friday to 249 on Monday. The most cases reported over the 4 days came from the 30 to 39 age range. The 36 cases from those 20 to 29 was second. Both age ranges each account for more than 20% of the total confirmed cases, 28.8% from those in their 20s and 20.6% from those in their 30s. Also on Monday, the Midland Health Department reported 27 cases from those 0 to 19, 22 cases from those 40 to 49, and 18 from those 50 to 59. Those 59 and younger were responsible for 91.6% of the confirmed cases on Monday's report. On the same day that Midland County Health Department came out with its first triple-digit count, the city put into place measures that it believes will protect its employees and residents. The city announced Monday the closure of City Hall, Midland Health Department, Midland Senior Center, Southeast Senior Center, MLK Community Center, Scarborough Lineberry House, and Animal Services Facility by appointment only. The city's Parks and Recreations Division also reported that the Parks Movie in the Parks series is postponed until further notice. Governor Greg Abbott's latest orders restrict gatherings of more than 10 people. Mayor Patrick Peyton has been vocal about the governor's executive overreach when it came to restrictions and required mask mandates. COVID-19. Wilson says no benefit using inhaled steroids for coronavirus, by Caitlin Randall. After an Odessa doctor said in recent media interviews he believes he's found the silver bullet for treating COVID-19, Midland Memorial's chief medical officer disputed that claim, saying there's no evidence the treatment offers any benefit to coronavirus patients. Dr. Richard Bartlett, a family medicine doctor in Odessa, has said in multiple interviews with broadcast and radio stations that he's treated dozens of COVID-19 patients with an inhaled form of budesonide, which is often used to treat asthma. When asked about the treatment during a press conference last week, Chief Medical Officer Dr. Larry Wilson said there have been no studies showing a benefit in using inhaled steroids to treat COVID-19. There is evidence that some steroids, including dexamethasone, may be effective in treating severe cases when given orally or intravenously, Wilson said. However, giving steroids to patients who are not severely ill may do more harm than good, he said. The way that steroids work is to create an immune suppression, he said, and you want an immune response to fight the virus. He said weighing the benefits of steroid treatment with the possibility of suppressing the immune system is a judgment call that should be made only on hospitalized patients. Most recently, Bartlett was interviewed Friday for the YouTube show America, Can We Talk? In that interview, he said early intervention with budesonide was the key to surviving the coronavirus and likened the drug to a silver bullet. Those who have shared the interview on Facebook are having it removed for violating the platform's policies regarding misinformation on coronavirus, according to commenters on the YouTube video. Bartlett made several claims in the video, which are demonstrably false, including that 20% of the world's population is at risk for dying from COVID-19, and that Japan and other countries have low numbers of coronavirus infections because they are using inhaled steroids. A series of case reports from Japan found patients improved on cyclosanide, a different inhaled steroid, but the reports are considered very low-quality evidence, according to an article in the European Respiratory Journal, because the treatment was given only to 3 patients, and it's unknown whether those patients would have improved without intervention. And while about 20% of people globally are considered at risk for developing a severe case of COVID-19, the mortality rate is estimated to be about 1 to 3%. Odessa Regional Medical Center's chief medical officer also addressed budesonide treatment in a report from KOSA-TV. Dr. Rohith Saravanan said blind controlled studies, rather than anecdotal evidence, are needed to prove any effectiveness. If they say, oh, 5 cases all solved, magic pill, silver bullet, well, that's not how science works, he said. Elections. Early voting in hospital election outperforms recent tax elections, by Stuart Doreen. Early voting for the July 14th sales tax election is off to a better than anticipated start, according to Midland Health officials. Russell Myers, CEO for Midland Health, said last week that turnout is greater than he expected. After 4 days, the number of people voting in the hospital district's quarter-cent sales tax election in person was 2,775. The number of people voting in person for the Republican and Democratic Party primary runoffs was 2,791. The number of people voting in person after 4 days of the March primaries were 3,401. Those numbers include the mailed-in votes, which in both July 14th elections were greater than 1,100. There was no voting on Friday or Saturday because of the July 4th holiday. Another 181 people voted in person in the hospital election and the primaries. Including mailed-in ballots, 4,086 votes were cast for the hospital district's sales tax election through Sunday. That compares well to entire voting periods for other non-general elections going back to 11 years. In 2009, when there was a $115 million hospital district bond referendum, 5,302 people voted early. The Midland County Elections Office showed 4,508 early voted during the 2016 tax ratification election, and 4,278 early votes were counted during the 2017 4B election. The 4,095 votes in person and mailed in for the runoffs are already greater than the 3,500 during the primary runoff in 2018. Early voting continues through Friday. City closes or modifies access to facilities, from staff reports. The City of Midland has closed some offices because of coronavirus. Closed to the public indefinitely are City Hall, Midland Health Department, Midland Senior Center, Southeast Senior Center, MLK Community Center, Scarborough Lineberry House, and Animal Services Facility by appointment only. The Citizens Collection Station, Hogan Park Golf Course, and all city parks remain open to the public. All city departments will remain operational, and the public is encouraged to use the list of numbers and emails to contact a specific department. For up-to-date information regarding COVID-19, go to midlandtexas.gov. Movies in the Park. The city's Parks and Recreation Division is postponing the 2020 Movies in the Parks series because of Governor Greg Abbott's order restricting gatherings of more than 10 people, according to a city spokesman.
Hello, this is April, reading the Midland Reporter-Telegram for Tuesday, July 7, 2020. Gas prices. Midland-Odessa gas prices have fallen 2 cents per gallon in the past week, averaging $1.94 a gallon on Monday, according to Gas Buddy's daily survey of 156 stations. Gas prices in Midland-Odessa are 19.7 cents per gallon higher than a month ago and stand 56.4 cents per gallon lower than a year ago. The following are historical gasoline prices for July 6 in Midland-Odessa going back 10 years. 2019, $2.50 a gallon. 2018, $3.05 a gallon. 2017, $2.12 a gallon. 2016, $2.15 a gallon. 2015, $2.52 a gallon. 2014, $3.54 a gallon. 2013, $3.39 a gallon. 2012, $3.33 a gallon. 2011, $3.51 a gallon. 2010, $2.67 a gallon. Source, Gas Buddy. Meeting, City Council, Budget Workshop. 10 a.m. today, City Hall, 300 North Lorraine. MCPL program continues. Midland County Public Library is offering virtual and in-person programs for National Summer Learning Week through Friday. The virtual programs are posted to the library's Facebook page at the time listed. The entire collection of MCPL's virtual programs may be accessed anytime on the library's YouTube page or website. In-person programs such as library lunches and take and make are designed to limit person-to-person contact and encourage social distancing. Library Lunches continues through August 7 at the Downtown Branch. Today's schedule. Theme, Dive into a Book Adventure. 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. Take and make bookmarks at both branches. 11 a.m. What We're Reading. Educational book recommendations for kids. Online. Noon to 1 p.m. Library Lunches with free books and Dr. Seuss bookmarks at Downtown Branch. West Texas Blowout is canceled. The West Texas Blowout, which was scheduled for July 17 through 18, has been canceled, according to a press release. City of Midland officials upheld Governor Greg Abbott's executive order that local government must approve outdoor gatherings in excess of 100 people and is prohibiting the event. Festival organizers are working with outlets and online ticket sellers for refunds, individual tickets, and VIP tables. The festival organizers are also considering rescheduling West Texas Blowout. For more information, visit westtexasblowout.com. MISD serves summer meals. Midland ISD summer meal schedule is in effect. Breakfast and lunch meals will be available for grab and go 10:30 a.m. to 12:30 p.m. Monday through Friday at 11 locations, according to a press release from the district. Meals are available for any child 18 or under, or those who receive services from school. The locations are Bonham, Bowie, Bunch, Burnett, Dizavala, Rusk, Santa Rita, South, and Yarborough Elementary Schools, Fire Station No. 4, and Twin Oaks Mobile Home Park. Daily menus are available at MidlandISD.net under Child Nutrition Services. Doug Russell Pool is open today. The city's pools, Doug Russell and Washington Family Aquatic Center, are open on alternating days during coronavirus pandemic. Doug Russell is open today for 2 3-hour sessions, noon to 3 p.m. and 4 to 7 p.m. Passes are $3 and go on sale at the pool 30 minutes before opening. Passes are good only for the day of purchase.
Midland Reporter Telegram Opinion, Tuesday, July 7th. Opinion Extra. Reflect on founders' views of free press. America's founders regarded a free press as so vital to the new nation that they took care to include that right in the First Amendment to the Constitution. Founders spoke glowingly about the press as a pillar of democracy and guarantor of liberty. Thomas Jefferson, for instance, famously wrote in 1787 that, "Were it left to me to decide whether we should have a government without newspapers or newspapers without a government, I should not hesitate a moment to prefer the latter. George Washington framed the issue of free expression in almost apocalyptic terms. If freedom of speech is taken away, then dumb and silent we may be led, like sheep to the slaughter. Yet discussing the free press of their day, the founders also could often sound like those who are decrying fake news in 2020. Under a barrage of criticism from newspapers published by his political opponents, Washington painted journalists as infamous scribblers. Benjamin Franklin, himself a successful newspaper publisher, described the press as a resentful, vicious institution comparable to the Spanish Inquisition. Jefferson frequently condemned the press as passionately as he had advanced their right to publish freely. I deplore the putrid state into which our newspapers have passed, and the malignity, the vulgarity, the mendacious spirit of those who write for them, he wrote in 1814. On this Independence Day, 244 years later, it's worth reflecting on the lessons the founders have for us as we assess the role and the practices of the news media today. The first lesson is that while the nation's leaders and institutions may chafe under the public criticism that accompanies reporting of their shortcomings, the role of the press in holding these leaders and institutions accountable is indispensable to the workings of a democratic society. More importantly, the press's proper role must be recognized by the leaders and institutions being held accountable. As abused as he was by the partisan press, Jefferson nevertheless declared, "I am for freedom of the press and against all violations of the Constitution to silence by force, and not by reason, the complaints or criticisms, just or unjust, of our citizens against the conduct of their agents." Among those slinging partisan unjust criticisms was the newspaper co-founded by James Madison, who reasoned that some degree of abuse is inseparable from the proper use of everything, and in no instance is this more true than that of the press. Yet he went on to argue that trying to regulate the abuse of the press threatens to strangle its vitality and utility to a free people. To the press alone, checkered as it is with abuses, the world is indebted for all the triumphs which have been gained by reason and humanity over error and oppression. And therein lies the most fundamental lesson the founders have for us in 2020. The press and the government may often have an adversarial relationship, but the government must not attempt to delegitimize the press and its work because they are essential to a free society. Would any of us want to live in a country where the news media isn't freely allowed to report on the actions of its government? Any harm done by an overreaching press would be nothing compared to a government left unchecked. As much as the news media may rub some the wrong way, it is frightening to think of a society with no free press. Tarred and slandered by the press of his time, often by newspapers owned or financed by fellow founders, Thomas Jefferson stayed true to that principle to the day he died on the 4th of July in 1826. On this Independence Day, all Americans should renew our commitment to Jefferson's description of the United States as a country which is afraid to read nothing and which may be trusted with anything, so long as its reason remains unfettered by law. Column by Dean Riddings, CEO of the Association America's Newspapers, Austin American Statesman, distributed by Tribune Content Agency. Midland Reporter Telegram Obituaries, Tuesday, July 7th. Barbara Lee Carmody. Barbara Lee Carmody left the world on July 1st after a lengthy illness. She was born to Vincent and Marcella Fortier on September 26, 1934, in Rochester, New York. She met and later married her husband, Seamus Edward Carmody. She was preceded in death by her parents, her daughter, Carlene Carmody, and husband, Dr. Seamus Carmody. She is survived by her children, Maura Jarldane, and husband, Mike, Brennan Carmody, and wife, Kathleen. Katie Hunter and husband Ricky, Kevin Carmody and wife Amy, as well as grandchildren Megan Hunt, Robert Hunt, Matthew Carmody, Emily Carmody, Liam Carmody, Seamus Carmody, Molly Carmody, Noel Carmody, and Morgan Callender, and great-grandchild Vanessa Carmody. Viewing will be held Monday, July 6th at Ellis Funeral Home from 5 to 7:30 p.m. Rosary will be held at 7. Services are scheduled for Tuesday, July 7th at 10 a.m. at St. Anne's Catholic Church. Thomas Lee Harlan. Thomas Lee Harlan passed from this life to a more peaceful one on July 2nd. A memorial service will take place at 11 a.m. Wednesday, July 8th at Nally Pickle and Welch Funeral Home Chapel. He was born September 23, 1940 in St. Louis, Missouri, to Thomas Franklin Harlan and Irene Richardson Harlan. Thomas is preceded in death by his parents, survived by his wife Joy, son Chris and wife Tess, his sister Janice Detloff and her husband Marty Detloff, granddaughter Callie Harlan. We want to thank Dr. Odukwu for all his guidance and Dr. Tejeda for his care at the hospital, thanks to Hospice of Midland. In lieu of flowers, donations can be made to the Pulmonary Fibrosis Foundation at 230 East Ohio Street, Suite 500, Chicago, Illinois, 60611, or a charity of your choice. Arrangements are under the direction of Nally Pickle and Welch Funeral Home and Crematory. Online condolences may be made at npwelch.com. Martha Louise Dickerson. Martha Louise Dickerson, 87 of Midland, passed away on Wednesday, July 1st. Due to the current circumstances, a celebration of life will be held at a later date. Louise was born on October 4, 1932 in Olney, Texas, to Fred and Leela Whitaker. Left to cherish Louise's memory is her son, Scott Dickerson, and wife, Karen. Daughter, Stacy Turner, and husband, John. Son, Larry Dickerson, and wife, Sandra. Granddaughters, Courtney McHugh and husband, Jay. Lindsay Turner and husband, Pat. Laurel Dickens and husband, Chris. Justine Turner. And Reese Turner. Grandsons, Caden Dickerson and wife, Haley. Zach Dickerson and wife, Lexi. Samuel Turner, and great-grandchildren, Brody McHugh, Blade McHugh, Cameron Turner, Kate Turner, Naomi Dickens. She is preceded in death by her husband of 62 years, Max Leo Dickerson, her parents, and brother Don Whitaker. The family would like to express their gratitude to the caregivers at Manor Park for their special care. In lieu of flowers, memorial donations may be made to Manor Park. Please specify Helen Greathouse Manor Assisted Living. Arrangements are under the direction of Nally Pickle and Welch Funeral Home and Crematory of Midland. Online condolences may be made at npwelch.com. Death Notice. Carol Ann Midkiff. Carol Ann Midkiff, 84 of Abilene, passed away July 3rd. Graveside service will be held at 10 a.m., Friday, July 10th, at Fairview Cemetery in Midland. Arrangements are under the direction of Nally Pickle and Welch Funeral Home and Crematory of Midland. Online condolences can be made at npwelch.com.
Hello, this is Kay reading the Odessa American for Tuesday, July 7th, 2020. Front page. Two Deaths Over a Weekend by Michael Merlo. M-M-E-R-L-O at OAOA.com. Medical Center Hospital reported that two COVID-19 patients died on the 4th of July as county cases continue to rise. The ninth COVID-19-related death at MCH was reported Saturday in a press release as a 61-year-old man with pre-existing conditions who tested positive at an urgent care and was admitted to the hospital on June 11th. Another death was reported Saturday at MCH as a 76-year-old woman with pre-existing conditions who was a resident at Focused Care at Odessa and was hospitalized on July 1st. A press release from Medical Center Hospital detailed that out of 532 positives, 38 patients are in the hospital. 15 patients are on 7 Central, including 2 from Focused Care at Odessa, 1 from Big Bend Regional, and 1 from Siena Nursing Home. 9 patients are on 8 Central, including 1 from Focused Care at Odessa. 14 patients are on the critical care unit, including 1 from Siena Nursing Home, and 8 of them are on ventilators. The release shows that no persons of investigation are in the hospital, and 508 tests are pending. The Ector County Health Department numbers, which hadn't been updated since July 2nd, were updated after 3 p.m. Monday, showing 1,392 total cases, but the ECHD press release stated that this is not the total number for probables, as we have not got them all updated at this time. The health department has struggled to get the numbers updated. Dr. Timothy Benton and County Commissioner Eddie Shelton have previously said this was due to an increase in cases. Benton previously said that it would take time to train newly hired contact tracers before the health department could return to daily COVID-19 number updates. The ECHD press release detailed that out of the 1,392 total cases, 946 are confirmed positive, 446 are probable positive, 1,138 are pending, 522 have recovered, and 11 Ector County residents have died from COVID-19 related complications. The ECHD website lists 859 cases as active. Odessa Mayor David Turner said that the Odessa Police Department will enforce Governor Abbott's mask order and that OPD will enforce the mandate if they get a call about someone not wearing a mask in a public area. Once that call is made, they will go to the site and they can issue warnings, and they will issue a warning first, he said. He said that after someone gets a warning, their name will be put in a database, and if they get caught following the warning, a ticket will be issued. It's not something we want to do, but unfortunately, when you have 1,392 cases, plus what's pending, it is getting to the point where we have to do something. I know some people say it's taking away their freedoms, but it's also protecting you and your families, he said. Odessa Regional Medical Center President Stacy Brown reported that out of 1,028 tests, 150 are positive, 767 are negative, and 111 tests are pending. 14 patients are in the hospital, and 9 of them are on ventilators. ORMC Chief Medical Officer Dr. Rohit Sarvanan said that ORMC is still waiting for test results from June 26th as clinical pathology labs became delayed after a reported overflow of test specimens. Sarvanan said that when a test is past a 10-day mark, it's not very useful because it's not in a meaningful time frame that you can actually give advice to the patient to either discontinue or continue isolation. He added that ORMC has been sending specimens to labs other than CPL. We are looking at many different options of where we can send, he said, adding that the University of Texas has been working with the community to see if their labs can help run some of the tests. Other news. The Ector County Republican Party voted on Saturday to censure Governor Greg Abbott, accusing him of overreaching in his response to the COVID-19 pandemic following his executive order that went into effect Friday, mandating that Texans wear face coverings in public areas in counties that have 20 or more positive COVID-19 cases. The resolution to censure Abbott for violating three or more of the core principles of the Republican platform was passed in a 10-to-1 vote, while three voting members were reportedly not present. According to a Texas Tribune article, Precinct Chair Aubrey Mayberry, who voted for the resolution, said that although the resolution doesn't have any teeth for now, it was important to send a message regarding what they see as Abbott's overreach. Turner and Shelton both said they didn't vote on the censure and said that they weren't contacted about the resolution. Other COVID-19 information. More information regarding the city mobile testing can be located at https://tinyurl.com/y8a8hz8r. County jury trials remain at standstill. Bland evokes mask policy at district attorney's office by Royal McGregor. RMCGREGOR at OAOA.com. The case against the 37-year-old Midland woman who was indicted by an Ector County grand jury in the deaths of 6-year-old Odessa twins Maya and Mia Coy is still pending. Ector County District Attorney Bobby Bland said during a phone interview on Monday that it's highly unlikely that any jury trial will be held before September due to the coronavirus. That case is still on the docket and it's still pending, Bland said. We can't move forward on it right now until we get a better sense of where we are as far as COVID-19. Angelica Garcia was indicted August 21st, 2019, on 2 counts of intoxication manslaughter, a second-degree felony, and 2 counts of aggravated assault with a deadly weapon, a second-degree felony. The 37-year-old Midland woman had 4 bonds, totaling $400,000, and she posted bail on October 1, 2019, jail records show. The indictments stem from a horrific crash that happened 9:04 p.m. July 3, 2019, near the intersection of East Highway 80 and Club Drive. Garcia was reportedly driving a gray 2014 Chrysler 200 east on the North Service Road of East Highway 80 near Club Drive. Garcia continued east through a barricade and struck the 6-year-old twin sisters, Maya and Mia Coy, who were standing near a fireworks stand before striking a large trailer. Both children were transported to Medical Center Hospital and later pronounced dead by medical personnel. Garcia stated she had been drinking at Toby's Lounge, an OPD affidavit stated. Garcia reportedly refused to cooperate with officers to take standard field sobriety tests. She was transported to Medical Center Hospital, and a blood draw warrant was obtained. Garcia reportedly showed signs of intoxication, which included slurred speech, red glassy eyes, unsteady balance when standing or walking, urinated on herself, and admitted she had drank, quote, too much, unquote. Though the district attorney's office has been able to complete cases via pleas, Bland said he and his staff are continuing to prepare for jury trials. Bland said he estimated the last jury trial his office had was in the middle of March. We have to make sure the cases are ready and make sure the discovery is done, Bland said. We have to make sure that we've done all the things that we need to do to try the case when it's ready. When the time comes, we will begin to tee them up and start trying them. The main thing is that all participants, including the public and the jury, will be safe. Bland said the district attorney's office implemented a mask policy about a month ago. He wants to ensure the safety of his staff. Bland also explained he doesn't want Texas to go through a full-blown shutdown again. I'm an Ector County Republican, but I disagree with anybody that says we don't need masks, he said. I'd rather keep the courts, businesses, and my office open with people wearing masks than them not wearing masks and have a shutdown again. Nobody wants businesses shut down again. One of the key ways to do it is to protect each other and ourselves. COVID-19 news by the numbers. Ector County total cases, both confirmed and probable, 1,392. Ector County negative, out of 9,361 tested, with 1,138 pending, 11 deaths. Recovered, 522. Active, 859. Midland County, 927 confirmed with 17 deaths. Texas, 200,557 confirmed with 2,431,861 tested. Total Texas deaths, 2,655. U.S. cases, 2,886,267 total confirmed and 129,811 deaths. Find out more at co.ector.tx.us or dshs.state.tx.us or the CDC site at tinyurl.com/TZTRJLF. Quick hits. Clay Chute fundraiser. Share, Sharing Hands, a Respite Experience, has scheduled Shooters That Share July 24th at Windwalker Farms, 2551 County Road 2801, Stanton. Registration starts at 9 a.m. Funds go to support Share, a nonprofit organization dedicated to caring for families who care for a child with special needs. COVID protocol will be taken to assure everyone's safety. Six-man teams, $175 per shooter, lunch included. Sponsorships are available. To pre-register, sponsor, or for more information, call Rachel Reinert at 432-818-1257. Email reinert at sharewtx.org or visit shootersthatshare.com. Training. Discover Odessa has scheduled a Texas-friendly free training event from 1 p.m. to 4:30 p.m. July 22nd or from 8:30 a.m. to noon July 23rd at the Wagner Noel Performing Arts Center, 1310 North Farm Road, 1788, Midland. Precaution measures will take place to keep attendees safe, which includes staggered seating, temperature checks at the door, sanitizer station, and masks will be provided but not required. To RSVP, call 333-7871 or email Carmen, C-A-R-M-E-N, at discoverodessa.org. Visit discoverodessa.org. From staff reports. Closing prices. Posted, $36.75. Futures, $40.63. Natural gas, $1.83. Benchmark U.S. fell 2 cents to $40.63 per barrel on the New York Mercantile Exchange. Hello, this is Kay reading the Odessa American for Tuesday, July 7th, 2020. Page 2, read. Summer Camp. This is a photo of founder and principal of Aid Invita, Linda Subia, leading children in song and dance during the school's rocking math and reading summer camp on Monday morning. The summer camp, lasting July 6th through 9th, aims to encourage math and reading fluency through rhythm, song, and dance. Eli Hartman, Odessa American. Hello, this is Kay reading the Odessa American for Tuesday, July 7th, 2020. Opinion. No, Susan Rice did not support the Iraq War. If Joe Biden takes my advice and chooses Susan Rice to be his running mate, then there will be criticism from people who opposed the Iraq War. That's because if you Google Susan Rice and Iraq War, you will find several sources, including Wikipedia, that say she supported it. Let me try to save critics and journalists from that error by setting the record straight. From everything I've been able to find, Rice did not support the Iraq War. She opposed it in a show of wise and independent judgment. I came by this information by falling victim to these sources and including a line in a recent column saying she endorsed the invasion. Shortly after it appeared online, I got a nice email from her press spokesperson, Erin Pelton, thanking me for the column, but informing me that Rice opposed the war. This came as a surprise. I asked for documentation, but wasn't convinced by the information she sent. I talked with Pelton by phone. She said she would see what else she could find. Then Rice called and explained, in a gracious and congenial way, how frustrating this urban legend has been for her. She recounted her thinking, assured me that colleagues from the Brookings Institution, where she worked at the time, would back her up, and said, with a laugh, "I'll swear on a stack of Bibles." Unsure what to think, and with the deadline for the Tribune's print edition looming, I deleted the reference. Later, I contacted Michael O'Hanlon and Ivo Dalder, fellow foreign policy scholars who were at Brookings with Rice at the time. O'Hanlon told me, "Susan was consistently against it from 2002. Dalder concurred. Susan was definitely against the war. Their memories confirm what Rice wrote in her memoir, Tough Love. From the start, I viewed that war of choice as a dangerous diversion from the main objective of defeating al-Qaeda globally and in Afghanistan." She served as an advisor to Howard Dean's 2004 presidential campaign because he was the only leading Democratic candidate to oppose the Iraq War. She signed up with Barack Obama in 2008 because he also opposed it. But she got falsely tagged as a supporter of the war, and the stain has refused to come out, mainly because of two statements that have been misinterpreted. In a December 2002 interview on NPR, she said, "It's clear that Iraq poses a major threat. It's clear that its weapons of mass destruction need to be dealt with forcefully, and that's the path we're on. I think the question becomes whether we can keep the diplomatic balls in the air and not drop any, even as we move forward, as we must, on the military side." But O'Hanlon notes, the military options she alludes to are not specified. For the Clinton administration, they were typically airstrikes or cruise missile strikes of limited duration and effect, not invasions. Rice also endorsed the idea of regime change, but there is less there than meets the eye. Bill Clinton signed a bill making it U.S. policy to, quote, support efforts to remove the regime headed by Saddam Hussein from power in Iraq and to promote the emergence of a democratic government to replace that regime, end quote. But he didn't think the cause called for a U.S. invasion. The point was to encourage Iraqis to do the job. In that December interview, Rice also said, quote, the administration frankly owes the American public a much fuller and more honest assessment of what the costs will be of the actual conflict, as well as the aftermath, the post-conflict reconstruction, and the costs are going to be huge, end quote. Rice didn't oppose the invasion as boldly and unequivocally as some did. Peter Beinart of the Daily Beast said he listened to interviews she did before the war and concluded, quote, "I still can't tell whether Susan Rice supported the war or opposed it," end quote. But being cautious and circumspect is not the same thing as supporting the war. Why does all this matter? First, because the Iraq War was the biggest foreign policy catastrophe since Vietnam and one most experts endorsed. Second, because Rice had to know her views carried a real risk. Most Democratic senators voted for the war resolution, including Joe Biden, Hillary Clinton, and John Kerry. Had the outcome been a glorious triumph, her opposition might have doomed her from serving in another administration. A lot of smart, knowledgeable people made the mistake of endorsing the Iraq War. Susan Rice deserves credit for not being one of them. Stephen Chapman. Chapman writes for the Chicago Tribune as well as being a syndicated columnist. Find out more. Read Chapman's daily blog, www.chicagotribune.com/news/opinion/Chapman. National View. Trump's aversion to granting visas. The point, why pursue a policy widely thought harmful? Well, from his perspective, harmful to whom? We can't tell you for certain whose interests are served by President Donald Trump's latest executive order on immigration, which took effect June 24th and suspends many new work visas through the end of the year. But we can easily tell you whose aren't, those of American businesses and industry, and thus of Americans who benefit from those companies' innovation and success. Putting up a not welcome sign for engineers, executives, IT experts, doctors, nurses, and other workers won't help our country. It will hold us back. That's from a U.S. Chamber of Commerce CEO, Thomas Donahue. Quote, "We oppose this, especially H-1B visas. Those are engineering and science. The U.S. just doesn't produce enough of those people to fill those jobs." From Shay Mandel, CEO of Medical Alley, a trade group in Minnesota. "In my experience, these skill sets are net job creators. Visa reform makes sense, but this is too broad." From Tesla CEO Elon Musk. "Sort of sounds like they didn't want it." So why do it? If we take the Trump administration at its word, the president has just signed a, quote, "proclamation suspending entry of aliens who present a risk to the U.S. labor market following the coronavirus outbreak," end quote. That would seem comforting if the action were likely to produce the desired effect. But it's not. The order blocks visas for a variety of jobs, some skilled, some seasonal. It limits the ability of companies that operate in a global arena to arrange stints in the U.S. for non-residents they already employ. By one estimate, from the nonpartisan Migration Policy Institute, it would keep 219,000 temporary workers out. According to the Trump administration, it will free up 525,000 jobs. One or the other must have the calculus wrong. In any case, business leaders, as expressed by Mandel above, don't think they'll be able to find workers with suitable skills if they can't draw them from overseas. It isn't as if Americans will fill the jobs instead. So, why do it? One possible explanation can be extrapolated from a recent comment by former National Security Advisor John Bolton in an ABC News interview about his now available book, The Room Where It Happened. Bolton said he didn't see any decisions during his time working for Trump for which re-election wasn't the major factor. But that may minimize Trump's underlying commitment to turning U.S. policy against immigrants. After all, his like-minded advisor, Stephen Miller, reportedly told supporters during a private call in April that coronavirus-related curbs on immigration were actually part of a long-term vision. A separate example is Trump's expansion of the number of asylum seekers subject to quick deportation within weeks, with minimal investigation of their claims. On Thursday, June 25th, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that such people as newly arriving non-citizens do not have the right to contest their cases in federal court. The Star Tribune. Your opinion is welcome. All submissions to the Odessa American must be accompanied by the author's name, address, and phone number. We may reject or edit any submission. Credits or bylines may or may not accompany published submissions. By submitting a letter or column, you assign to us all rights, title, and interest in the submission, including all copyrights. Letters should be emailed to oaletters@oaoa.com. To send your comments to the OA via the Internet, address them to oaletters@oaoa.com.
Hi, this is Jack. I'm reading this Midland Reporter telegram for Tuesday, July 7th, 2020. Education section. Teachers, students shouldn't fear STAR. Assessment provides MISD with vital information by Stuart Doreen. The return of a state assessment test in 2021 is needed, and Midland ISD parents and teachers should not fear it. There were headlines across the state last week that the state will move forward with the administration of the State of Texas Assessments of Academic Readiness, STAR, test in the 2021 school year. The Austin American-Statesman reported that Texas Education Commissioner Mike Morath told State Board of Education members Tuesday that the testing will have some changes, including an expanded testing window and an extended period for online testing. Testing needs to happen. We cannot go another year not knowing how our students are progressing versus the rest of the state. Assessment is good. It allows us to have a metric to see how our district, not just teachers and students, but the entire district, measures against others. Our community needs to know MISD's deficiencies, and with students having been given a pass this year, it is mandatory that we get back on track with assessments as soon as possible. In talking to people in education, one worry I hear repeatedly is that the 3 months off campus at the end of the 2019-20 academic year will put entire student populations in a hole that could take years to climb out of. We must know where the district stands and what those measures were when it came to online learning. We must know where we succeeded and where we failed. The news about STAR brought an expected reaction that it will put too much pressure on teachers and students. I hate to hear this because that is not the way it should be. Teach the best you can, and we will let the chips fall where they may on assessments like the STAR. At the same time, community members, parents, and district staff must acknowledge that we have not matched the results of other districts around the state when it comes to academic performance. That must change because the TEA has told Central Office that this district must do better, and because for more than 10 years the district has not performed to a level at which it is capable. Anyone wanting to point fingers misses the greater point. And those wanting to put more pressure on teachers and students because of a systemic issue are needlessly placing blame and shouldn't be part of the conversation. The goal with every hire at Midland ISD, or any other school for that matter, should be a person who can bring positive results when it comes to the academic performance of this district. It doesn't matter the level, from pre-K teacher to superintendent. If that person doesn't accomplish that one goal, then he or she is not useful to the overall mission of the district. I go back to 2015 being a watershed moment for the district. That is when an entire community learned that our district ranked 199th out of the largest 200 school districts in the state when it came to academic performance. Only Ector County ISD ranked lower. We would not have learned that without information from Education Resource Group. And since then, we know that the number of failing campuses continues to the point where the ones with the worst records are handed over to charter companies. How do we know what we must do better as a district? Because of an assessment. How do we know that 9 schools failed and another 10 received D's and 38 rated received either an A or a B during the same year? Because of an assessment. This same assessment shows that districts from El Paso to the Valley are outperforming Midland ISD on the same test. That same assessment shows that demographics or socioeconomic status does not hold back other districts. If someone wants to continue to put pressure on teachers and students concerning the administration of an assessment test, they are missing the point. Let the teachers teach. Let the students learn, and the star will take care of itself. Venture away from that too much, and your issues are greater than what is taking place in the classroom.
We've been reading from the Midland Reporter Telegram and the Odessa American. Please stay tuned for the weather, followed by the second hour's reading of the newspapers.